Okay, David Stoy.
Well, I feel I'm here under completely false pretenses, since I meant to be discussing the whole session, all the sessions before this one, while I've only been here since lunch. Now, I didn't just come for lunch. It is true, I'm very happy to be escaping the LSE at the moment and come to this lovely place. And as I said before, I thought the session which I was listening to was very insightful in fact, and raises a lot of questions. So I want to say first of all, I very much my own work's very much moving in this direction of the importance of looking at the nation state, which in part influenced by John Campbell's more recent work. And I do think we need to think how the nation state ties into the complex of institutions of whether we call it civil society or whatever, and the fact that this works in extraordinarily different ways in Ireland to the way in which it works in Denmark, at least as far as I'm reading it. I'm not sure how much value there is in using or in looking at comparisons between different countries, between Denmark and Ireland, from the perspective of using those comparisons to change policies or institutions in other countries. And that's in part because, as it's certainly one of John's main points, our current institutions, our understanding about how we work with each other and everything else, go back a long way in history. And the idea that you can therefore change institutions, or if you do change institutions, expect them to work, if I'm thinking about Britain, in the way in which they work in Denmark, would be a silly approach to make. On the other hand, I do think it's incredibly important to understand how institutions work in different countries, to be able to understand how a whole range of things, I'm particularly interested in innovation, work differently in different countries. And if we're just talking very, if I just put this in parentheses, about the question of liberalisation and globalisation, as I see it, I don't see globalisation as being responsible for flexibilisation. I see that as very much coming from the very major changes in technology, which have come from the fact that we're now in a different technological regime to the regime which I was brought up in for most of my life. We've moved away from that, and the IT revolution has very fundamentally changed things, and that's what seems to me to be the perfectly sensible responses to that is what seems to me to be responsible for greater flexibilization, simply because it puts hugely greater power into the hands of skilled, educated people than was the case before. Now, one thing which is really fascinating, which was mentioned, is the different way in which that decentralization of autonomy takes place in a country like Denmark to the way in which it takes place in Ireland, and also something I'm very interested in, the UK, as Ned Lawrence's work and Lundevall's work makes very plain. There are huge differences in the way in which decentralization works in this country compared to Denmark. So I think that's an important point to make, that we shouldn't be over obsessed by things like yellow unions and the posted worker directive, which are very particular rules which the EU has developed, and they are things which may easily change. And if one brings politics into this at all, one of the compromises of Danish politics, linking the Danish People's Party to Social Democrats, could very easily be modifying the way in which in Denmark the Posted Workers Directive operates. So I very much agree with John's John Campbell's view that globalization, far from undercutting local national democracy or suborning the role of the nation state, my view would be to say that globalization increases the autonomy of the nation state, and it does so. Denmark's a very obvious example. It does so for a number of reasons, but one very basic reason is just that the more specialized Denmark becomes as a result of, in my view, a lot of the technological change taking place, the more Denmark becomes valuable to the global system, and therefore the idea that the global system is going to impose rules on Denmark in terms of about what it does, let's just say in terms of the welfare, their welfare state, becomes implausible. But that's just by the way. I would have liked to have seen, because I felt you were very much on the edge of moving in this direction in your charts and discussion. I would have liked to see it in relation to, thinking about this in relation to Denmark, more linkage between sectors. When we were working on biotech startups in Germany, it was very clear that the biotech startups were much less like the radical innovation of Silicon Valley than some people thought might have been the case, to a more sort of German model of things taking slightly longer, people having slightly more autonomy within these startups. That linked very closely to the fact that a lot of the goods which were being produced were being produced for companies who themselves were producing very specialized goods, so that a whole wave of networked connections from these biotech startups moved across the German economy to other companies in the other specialized companies in the German economy. And it would be very interesting to know, in relation to the IT startups in Denmark, whether there isn't quite a lot of connection between those startups and the very highly specialized and high value-added manufacturing companies, small manufacturing companies. That'd be an example of what I see as in the linkages between sectors. And those are linkages which don't exist in Ireland or in the UK to anything like the same extent. And because of that, you can then have, you can then have this very different type of work organization, which I thought was really, really interesting, the way you were explaining that, in both in Ireland and in the it's really similar in all sorts of ways in the Golden Triangle in the UK. So that would, going on from that, I then see that this extraordinary pattern of institutional networks and this whole idea of a negotiated system where negotiations take place at a range of different levels, but are taking place all the time. And as I said, Sean, I like that notion of your negotiated construction of, or whatever the exact phrase was, of the of future equilibria in a country which is in Denmark, which is it's a very innovative country and a very innovative economy. It may not be innovative in a Silicon Valley sense, but it's very innovative in the way in which incremental innovation is going on all the time in a lot of these manufacturing sectors. So I thought that was a really nice picture I was being presented with. I'll just finish by talking about what we're really concerned about in the UK. I keep on veering between talking about England and the UK, which just shows the sort of crazy state we're in. Anyway, United Kingdom actually includes Northern Ireland, but...
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Sorry, but no. Can I just say, it's the United Kingdom is Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Great Britain is Scotland, Wales, and the British Isles.
The mainland.
Hey, we're with you there. We're all together. And we're just, unless we change geographical names, we won't be able to divide our... Anyway, what we're really interested in is the geography of huge agglomerative successful graduate intensive cities, London, Manchester, increasingly Liverpool and Leeds. These are all places which are strong Remain voters in the Brexit referendum. And the peripheral towns around these areas, we're actually doing a study of Manchester in relation to the peripheral towns around Manchester. These are places which have all got football teams, by the way, working class or industrial origins: Bolton, Oldham, Bury, Accrington, Rochdale, and so on. Now, these were really prosperous places for a large chunk of the 20th century, and certainly up to the 60s and early 70s. And since then, they've simply collapsed. And the story is a very, very interesting story. It's the UK historically had essentially industrial core areas. So, and Manchester was one core area, actually mainly in textiles, where Manchester was the center of the core, which had the most sophisticated manufacturing, which had most of the research, which had the good universities, which also had the top financial companies in the north, the top legal firms, and so on, accountants and so on. So everything was of that sort was focused on Manchester. These were the peripheral towns which fed Manchester with slightly less sophisticated goods and so on. And all that really was a symbiotic system. And when industrialization collapses, then these peripheral towns are left hanging and have become in a really bad situation. Now, thinking then about Denmark, it turns out Denmark also has just the same phenomenon of these big successful cities, Aarhus and Copenhagen and so on. And when you look at this on a map, you find that there are peripheral towns around these places. And when you look at we were looking at this on a map in relation to the Danish People's Party party votes. The exactly parallel to what you do on a map in terms of Manchester, the city centres have got no DPP votes. These peripheral areas around those city centres have got are the stronghold of Danish People's Party votes. So this seems a really interesting phenomenon. But when you look, we then looked at we worked out measures of populism, which you could then use European Social Survey to, and various mapping data to tie into to think about how much populism there is. You find that the actual level of populism is very significantly lower, as happens in Denmark, than in the England, but of course we don't have a populist party, but that's because of the electoral system. So the electoral system is really a bad, it really screws things up when you try and map populism into across countries. So the question then is, what's going on in Denmark? And Sweden, for that matter, actually, and Norway and Finland, just as it happens. Please note, I do not believe these countries are at all similar. I now really think that this notion of nation states being pretty specific, actually. I think the nation state is a really important concept. And I think the locus of power in the world is a set of nation, at least those of advanced nation states, is where most political power actually resides in the world. But it is interesting that in all these four countries, the level of populism maps into something. Well, that something turns out to be education and training and retraining, that these modify the nature of populist feelings. People are still populist because indeed of the history of Denmark is such a strong history that nationalism is a very natural reaction to difficulties as have arisen. Now, behind all that is then a very interesting question of what goes on in these peripheral towns, and indeed the towns outside the big cities in Denmark. And a lot of that has to do with the fact of with the way in which the nation state has close links to the to local government, whereas in the UK we have a central government which pretty much controls everything, and local government is really, really unimportant. It's very hierarchical relationship. We have no connections as compared to Denmark and Sweden. We have no close connections, networks between government at different levels and the business community, let alone, needless to say, unions. So you have in these countries the capability, and this comes up very nicely in the Pierre Christensen book on innovation in the Nordic countries.
Sorry,
Pierre Christensen.
Oh, Pierre Christensen.
Yeah. You have this capacity there to think very carefully about for bigger companies, if they break up, for these networks of actual people, engineers, people in business, technicians, and so on, to recreate themselves. To pay a great deal of attention to the question of, can you work with government at a local level? In actually, it turns out that education and retraining institutions are key institutions. Now, in the UK, they're really centred in the big cities. There's been a lot of experimentation in Denmark, particularly in Sweden, to then build universities or technical institutes or research institutes linked to bigger universities in cities, and to be working in the area which innovation needs to take place in these, as it were, peripheral localities, which would be consigned in the UK. So I find this incredibly interesting, this type of way of looking at things, of understanding these dense networks, where there's a lot of understanding about long-term. You may not have long-term relationships with particular companies, but long-term relations across long-term, people haven't been concerned about long-term reputations, about their networks, and so on. And then being able to work with government to actually translate, to bring about the public sector resources to bring about innovation. And so that I find very interesting. And that really, I mean, I was, when Felix and Sean were talking, I found really sort of coming through in my mind, and that would be my sort of reaction to what was a splendid session. I just really apologise for, as it were, playing hooky from the LSE, but missing the morning session.
Thank you, David. Okay, I mean, that have been really excellent insights from both speakers. Thank you very much, both of you, for that. So, does the spirit move anybody to ask a question? Yes, it does, obviously.
Both of you had great comments, and I take them to heart. And David, we should talk about populism. I'm writing a book right now, as fast as I possibly can, about Donald Trump's rise to power. And you and I may have some interesting things to say to each other about where the populism is and so on and so forth. But anyway, but if the question of this session is, you know, do we still need to pay attention to the small open economies? I think the answer is yes. And maybe for reasons that are becoming increasingly important as globalization goes on. The one slide that I didn't get a chance to talk about was the slide in my presentation was, you know, what are the implications of all this resilience or not in small open economies for the big ones? And I think that in a way, size is beginning not to matter so much anymore. I mean, the big countries are becoming increasingly vulnerable as well. The little guys have been living with vulnerability for a long time. Some have learned to deal with it more effectively than others. But even the United States, arguably the hegemonic power in the world, it got whacked hard by the financial crisis. And there's nobody that says there's not another one in the offing. So I do believe that the big ones can learn lessons from the little ones in terms of what does it take to be flexible, adaptable, resilient. And that feeds right back into this question of what about the nation state? You know, the nation states helped make globalization. Let's be real about this. And if they wanted to, they could unmake globalization. Donald Trump wants to unmake globalization. We'll see how that goes.
So does Theresa May.
So does Theresa May. That's right. In fact, they should be good buddies, as long as Donald stays in office. But I think that the nation state is absolutely important in all of this, as are subnational level states, because even in the United States, for example, and this gets to the populism issue, in the upper Midwest, prior to the financial crisis, there was a move in Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Josh Whitford writes about this in his book, where the automobile industry had hit hard times, particularly for the suppliers, because the supply chains had shifted to the south and overseas. And what to do about this? Well, they started to create networks between the unions, between the supply companies. This is in the metalworking industries, local technical colleges to try and, this is a Chuck Sable-like argument, right? Yeah, yeah. Pool resources, figure out new products that they could create. So we're not going to make bumpers for cars anymore. Maybe we'll make bicycle frames or something like that. And the state was involved, heavily involved in that. And as I understand it, the small companies that were involved in this were actually in sort of the periphery of Milwaukee, for example, which is where the populism came from, in part, that brought Trump to power. So there's some interesting connections, I think, even in a big country like the United States, for a lot of the stuff that the two of you were talking about here. So.
When you're responding, when you're responding to that, David, just one thought that you might respond to. I saw a very interesting program on the BBC World Service one morning, the television version of it, but it was to do with supply chains. A manufacturer in the south of England manufacturing engine blocks. So the basic block was cast in somewhere in the south of England. It was sent over then to Germany for some kind of polishing. It was sent from, say, Berlin up to Turin for another process. From that back to Berlin, from there back to south of England, and another move to another country before it finally was a finished product. I mean, the sheer scale of the difficulty in the context of Brexit or whatever to interdict that type of supply chain. I mean, is anybody thinking much about that, do you think?
Yeah, well, certainly Merkel has been thinking about it because she made a speech on just those lines, in fact, yesterday, saying, can you imagine if you really looked at the incredible tissue of relations between companies across countries in Europe, can you imagine what would happen if we had to renegotiate the actual trade agreements, and in particular, if you had to have an inspection process when you're moving between countries? So that's very, very much taken on board. I think what you say is really interesting. It also, it's one big difference between the UK actually and the US, which is we're a very centralized country. The US, on the other hand, is a very decentralized country. And when you look at things like community colleges and how community colleges could be set up, as it were, by essentially municipalities setting up a community college district and so on, it certainly seemed to us a big advantage which the Americans have.
Okay, anybody else? Yeah, sure.
I mean, it was interesting to listen to your analysis of the Danish case. I would say two things. The one being that I think the whole issue about populism and the rise of Trump and other populist leaders and votes in Europe has something to do with the equality between regions. We have too many regions where people, in a sense, are feeling they're standing on the platform and a train is just driving past them. And I think the reason it's not gone that bad in Denmark is in a sense that there is, and I assume there might be also in future willingness to transfer money to those more less affluent areas, so that the living standard is not too different between different areas. So that was one about this populism. I think that the welfare state in that respect might have an impact on what's going on. And my second remark is that, I mean, despite we've been talking since Keynes' day about automatic stabilizers, there's for a long time been a discrediting of the welfare state as a burden, not as part of the solution. And I think one of the reasons that the Danish welfare state has been more resilient than other welfare states has been the, in a sense, extremely close connection between the public and the private sector. And making a distinction between public and private is in fact not always a good way of thinking about it. I mean, all big Danish companies today, I think with the exception of Lego, has only been possible due to the welfare state bought the products. And the welfare state were the one investing, so to speak, in buying the products, making it possible for the company to grow. And it was in the late 70s, it was invested by a minister of environment at that stage in both solar and wind energy, making possible for Vestas to take off. So I think one forgets that the option the state has by their buying power to influence the economic development, and taking that buying power into consideration in many different ways. I mean, all hospitals around the world buy medicine, they buy food, they buy cleaning, they buy a lot of issues. And using that as a way of investing in new things might be a way to say that this distinction between different welfare states, is in a between different public and private, is in a sense not a real distinction one should make of. So I think that's also part of the reason why the Nordic countries have been better, because there has been a better linkages between the public and the private sector, and it's not been that traumatic. I mean, like in UK, it's always been traumatic by nationalising, non-nationalising, etc., etc. And in Ireland, as far as I remember the history, you've always had the problem that you never did really have any labour movement. Instead, you have, as you indicate, a conflict between whether or not you should cooperate or not cooperate with the British. But no proper trade union, no proper labour development saying we need part of the pie.
Anybody else? Yeah.
I want to answer the question that asked today. Small comments to the model. The truth of the matter is that for
those of us on small islands like this, which are constituted into states, we've no bloody choice whether it's a model or not. We've got to make it work to import all the stuff we need, from the gas that's needed to power the electricity, to the computers, the pens, everything. You look around us, you know, we need that stuff if we're going to have some kind of a standard of living. We're going to have to trade, therefore we're going to have to be open. But my question is more serious, and it's really directed to Niamh based on your work on the Irish administrative database. What kind of a state fails to recruit to its only police force for 5 years? I mean, what conception do the people in power, the elites in power, the people on the NESC and the civil servants and the politicians, that they can't see that you need to keep the police force up to a certain level? There's something wrong, that they don't have that basic understanding of what a state is about, based on that fact alone. Now, am I exaggerating?
Anybody else before you come out? Anybody else? Yeah, Sean, yeah.
I suppose two things, really. One is this question of the chains and networks. I mean, it is very interesting to look at even the employment profile of Ireland and Denmark, and you can see it in the software industries, like finance. You know, finance employment is higher in Ireland, and you have a whole chunk of financial software, you know, companies. So your average programmer leaving college today in Denmark versus in Ireland is more likely to work on programming systems for wind power in 10 years' time in Copenhagen and for financial wizardry in Dublin, you know. So there is a significance.
Well.
I mean, that's a very interesting point. But I had a different question, which is linked to Ben's point about purchasing, which is, in a sense, if the a lot of the employment is so you, I think you see two trends in employment. One is technologically driven and moving towards IT based and so on. But the other one is, you know, work that was previously done essentially in families moving into either the public or the private sector. And in some ways, in terms of employment, probably the bigger effect. So then, in a sense, do those become networked together as well? So, you know, does Rochdale become the kind of care center for Manchester, you know, and what's the way that you organize that? You know, that's one question. And by the way, what you were describing reminded me of the ESRC did this fantastic program of research in the mid-1980s about local economies, and I think John Urry and Roger Penn and all that. But it was, there was a whole load of interesting studies which were about local networks, labour forces, sectors and so on. But anyway, it might be worth revisiting.
Absolutely.
And then the other question was around cities. And in a way, just listening to what you were saying, it struck me that when I was in grad school, there was like globalization, which was killing the nation state. And then we were all reading Peoria and Sable. We thought, great, cities are going to save us because they will embed globalization in cities. And in a sense, it worked. You know, and Denmark is more about Copenhagen and Aarhus than it ever was, and Ireland's about Dublin and so on and so forth. So it's embedded, but in a way what you're describing is the problem with the success of that, which is what happens to the nation if the economy is organized through cities, then what happens to the nation? And I wonder about Jutland, for example, the Leave, the DPP voters in Jutland, even if they get the money, I wonder if they will actually stop voting DPP, because I suspect that the key to the whole Danish model is that people are involved, they feel part of the model. So they're not just getting the money from the model, they're actually, the employment rate is high and they're working, and they're working in more or less the same conditions as other people, even though obviously there's inequality. But I wonder whether, you might be money, but you know, there's kind of a respect dynamic to it as well.
Great, thanks Sean. Niamh, do you want to questions?
Yeah, well, I think Donal's question is kind of rhetorical because it's, you know, no, it's real as well, because there are weaknesses in the capacity to prioritise and do strategic planning that are part of the kind of a rather passive approach to administrative organisation in Ireland. But I think it links to something that we haven't talked about so far, and that is that, first of all, we seem to have stabilised on this idea. We seem to have converged on this idea of a low tax, low spend model as part of the growth strategy. The very strong consensus that people have noted that means that issues like, you know, institution building or the sort that Mary was talking about, you know, are under resourced and under conceptualised, because there isn't really a conception of how to channel money into and how to really enable the wider community, as opposed to the productive, the kind of the labour force productive elements of the economy. So we prioritise living in an economy over living in a society. But behind that is this big issue of the adaptive capacity that the Irish economy has within the constraints that we've chosen to impose upon ourselves, chiefly EMU. And we haven't talked about it at all. But it is a huge challenge of adaptive capability, and has been since 1992. You know, first we did it well when we still had some wiggle room, and then it turned out to be the mother and father of a disaster. And I'm talking about from 1999 on, with a deluge of uncontrolled financial inflow. And it's in that sense that I'm talking about globalization. Globalization makes all the difference. And I don't mean supply chains in this connection. I mean financial globalization, unrestricted financial flows that are particularly challenging to periphery countries that will be seen as kind of safe havens for hot money, you know, in the good times. And then you get sudden stops, you know, we're kind of the third worldization of Ireland. Like Mexico had it, you know, Argentina had it, you know, all over the world there's been financial crisis has been common. We haven't had one in Europe in general Europe, apart from Sweden, Scandinavia, you know, for like three generations or something. So EMU presents these huge problems of adaptation to a constrained monetary regime where you can't devalue and where you have no control of your interest rates, and where then increasingly the fiscal policy is tightly constrained. So, you know, we have choices about how much we tax and how much we spend, but unless we tax more, we can't spend more. And that means that there's increasingly just kind of sharp divisions over where will the money go into hiring more police or better resourcing for the universities and better education and training, or doing something about the appalling state of the hospitals, or what about children with scoliosis who have to wait, you know, 7 years to get diagnosis and getting up in more pain? What is this? What is an economy for but to improve living standards for the population? We don't have those conversations in Ireland. It's all about Ireland Inc. and GDP and so on. And so the scale of social needs is regarded as a kind of a social collateral of the success of the economic model. So in that sense, the constraints of being in a small open economy are particularly challenging, and the resilience issues and so on. We've been talking mostly about the productive and distributive labour market sides of these issues, but the monetary and fiscal challenges and the capacity to manage imaginatively within those constraints, given the opportunities we've chosen by pegging our currency and so on. These are quite considerable, I think, have overwhelmed us as well.
I think, ironically, our decision to go in the first case was predicated on Britain eventually going in as well. The way things have changed. And it wasn't unreasonable at the time, if you remember. Blair was actually in favour of it.
Yeah, but it was also, floating your own currency is a really hard thing to do as a small open economy in the world.
Absolutely, sure. I mean, that's a part of the volatility we had prior to.
I know, that's my point. So we pegging to the UK, it turned out to be a really bad idea. We tried to break away from that. Pegging to Germany, to the Deutschmark, turned out to be a very good idea. And the same worked for the Netherlands and for Belgium and for Luxembourg. So they were kind of lucky. Their regional hegemon turned out to be, a kind of a stable performer, but imposing other sorts of adaptive constraints on these economies to make sure that they didn't fall out of sync with whatever their trade.
I'm just conscious of the time, so we're over time. So maybe I'll just have one more round in case anybody wants to say anything. Very important, and then we'll wrap it.
Right.
Yeah, well, Rory, yes, please.
Yeah, sorry, thanks very much. I was very struck by David's opening remark, almost, was that he wasn't sure how much value there was in comparisons with a view to changing policy, and that partly the reason you gave was that institutions go way back and then you added, and I think it's an important kind of point, and therefore if we change them in the light of some comparison, we can't even be sure they'll work the way we desire them to work, from the comparative case. And I think that's really interesting, and I don't know if Sean and the team have thought about that, but it's something certainly working in policy that we struggle with over a very long period, is how to be both aware of these much larger structural things and conceptual things, at the same time, to kind of not naively think we can import structures and models. And in many ways, I think we maybe I would share many ways the negative comments about the Irish state that have been made. But there's parts of it, and Sean has written very well about this. There's parts of it that if they heard this conversation, and some of these conversations, would be surprised or maybe annoyed, because there's been this taking David's point, I think, which is a really important one, addressing problems which are in front of people, whether it's development of the food industry or expanding the scale of third level education or whatever, the parts of the system have been quite creative. And other parts not, and I think maybe that's worth thinking about. And again, certainly, at times, at this more fine-grained level, international comparisons can be useful. I think one of the attractions I think of using, but then not taking too seriously, these kind of varieties and worlds of welfare, is that when you drop down a few levels. To education and training, or integration of migrants, or dealing with addictive problems in the labour market, then I think to a degree you can make partly useful comparisons and learnings from how they do schooling in Finland or active labour market policy in Denmark. I don't know if people would agree, but I think it is. I think the policy implications of this way of thinking, analysing, are well worth sort of teasing a bit. We can't maybe do it now.
Before you respond, David, I'll just ask if there's any one last question that anybody might want to ask, and then I'll. No, okay. Go ahead.
So very, very good. See, so Theresa May has really pushed all her economic policy, or a very large amount of it, on a massive expansion of apprenticeships, which she's borrowed from Germany. Now, we've got tons of information, tons of evidence in the UK already that whenever this is done, it's always a disaster. And Theresa May, well, bless her, she couldn't think of anything else to say. And talking about apprenticeships, she wants to revive industry. She wants all these peripheral towns to be, you know, smoke coming out of chimneys, big chimneys again, and so on and so forth. And this is really, a nostalgic appeal to voters about, we can bring back all this. We can bring back all this stuff. But that is it's a very good example of actually the policy move, which makes sense to do, is to borrow from community colleges in the United States. That's something which is actually the way they work is actually quite doable. Unfortunately, though, to make community colleges work, you have to have a far more decentralized political system than we have. So there are a whole number of further moves which you'd have to make.
Can I just say something quickly? Just on that. Yeah. And I think this is something that I'm very keen on as well, because I think that we've never got our heads around in Ireland the right way to use evidence-based policy. Because evidence-based policy is vitally important if what you want to know about is how best do you organise early school education for children to enable them to whatever. Look to Finland because it has great metrics. But we have to be very careful because, just as David said, you know, we can think of other examples. Evidence-based policy making has a huge political hinterland. There are values and priorities built into it. So if you get the technical, can I isolate what the technical problem is that you want to solve, an evidence-based policy answer is exactly right, and we need far more of that. And I wish Michelle Norris was here to just validate that. But Owen Flaherty and other people from who value these sorts of things but we also need to remember that you can't just import a model, you know. So even just getting the analytical categories right is absolutely vital.
Okay, thanks very much, Niamh. Yeah, just a thought I'm going to ask Sean to wrap up in a minute. Just a couple of thoughts that occur to me. I just wonder whether we shouldn't try and change the language around discourse a little bit. I mean, we talk, and I do certainly, a lot about populism, you know. But I think to some extent there's a little bit of a risk that you pigeonhole sort of people, you know, and say, well, right, that there aren't really deep-seated, serious problems underneath that kind of those fears and so on that have been expressed. And that, you know, if you can box it as populism, then a conventional politics can go on in its normal way, you know, that it's without taking account of those real difficulties that there are. I don't mean to present dystopian solutions like our friend in the United States or anything like that, but like there are real deep-seated problems that I think in our world we have to sort of orientate our politics to try and deal with. The last thing I just want to say, I want to give you a quote from Søren Kierkegaard, who, as you know, was a Danish philosopher of the 19th century. And he said this: philosophy is perfectly right in saying that life must be understood backwards, but then one forgets the other clause, that it must be lived forward. The more one thinks through this clause, the more one concludes that life in temporality never becomes properly understandable, simply because never at any time does one get perfect repose to take a stance backwards. So I think that sort of encapsulates our difficulty, shall I say. Sean, do you want to wrap up? And thanks, Ivan. Thank our speakers very much, and a very, very interesting session. Much appreciated.